This admonition in Hebrews 12, which we read a moment ago, follows directly from the Old Testament. Sometimes Hebrews 11 is called, and I'm a little bit amused as I read Hebrews 11, certain people who are very well, who are listed as people of faith, as to what they're, but when he comes down near the end, the preacher who has run in presenting his sermon, and he's trying to get all of it in at the very end, so he just makes some several statements about faith at the end of Hebrews 11. And it's those sweeping statements that I want light of running the race with endurance. Christians who were discouraged, Jewish people living in the land of Palestine, were about to defect, about to leave Christ and go back to their apostasy. Andrews contrasts the law of Moses with the people of Christ, emphasizing again and again that the gospel is so much better than the law before the law. In terms of Hebrews, the gospel, therefore, is better. Now, with that, as tonight, we run the Christian life. And in Hebrews, the writer comes near the end of this admonition for in the Christian life. I want to emphasize with him, faith, the New Testament, this is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. Faith experiences victories. And I want to begin in verse 32. And I want to emphasize three important points. Make the points, and then we'll come back to next. And people of faith often won their victories facing great odds. From a human standpoint, there wasn't any reason to believe that they could win the victory. And yet, against great odds, they overcome. Many of these great people of faith, or maybe I should say faith, face certain death, but they never flinched, and the reason that they were able to overcome great odds, even in the face of certain death, was by the power. I like what the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 10, 35 and 6. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, the promise. They kept the promise before them. And by the power of God, they were able to win a victory by faith. Now, let's look more closely, beginning at verse 32. And what more shall I say? And he's run out of time, and so he's going to have to bring it to a conclusion. What more can I say? Time would fail me. People need to get to the cafeteria, he said. Time would fail me. Now, he's going to list some people of faith without telling us specifically what they did. Names that some of which are at least will be familiar to you. Time would fail me to tell of Gideon. All he does is... But Bible students remember Gideon, reluctant as he was at the beginning, took 300 men and put a whole army of the Midianites and great victories for Israel. He says, what more could I say of Gideon? And back, the military man went with Deborah, the old who served as a judge. We don't know a lot about that. Deborah said, you must lead the army against the enemy, but he was the military general, won the victory. What more could I say of more people in his death than he did God's people? Your temple of that pagan god, he pillars and pulled them, and the pillars broke down, and the building collapsed, and the enemies were destroyed, and was destroyed with them. What shall I say more about Gideon, or Barak, or Samson, or Jephthah may not be as familiar to us as Samson or a Gideon. But Jephthah was rejected by his family. God, and by his faith, he won battles during the period of the judges for Israel. And then he says, and also of David. Doesn't mention David. David is one of the greatest of Old Testament characters. He's the greatest king who ever reigned in Israel. David than most other people in the Old Testament history. But he says, what shall I say of David? And I wonder if he had in mind David's confident Goliath and how he was confident by his faith that God would give this shepherd boy a victory over a giant. Or Samuel. Samuel was one of the greatest of the judges and the greatest of the prophets. It was Samuel and his faith that great Israel at a time that she was very low spiritually. So what should I say about the others, he tells us. And he concludes, prophets. The prophets who paid such a great price to fulfill the mission and ministry that God gave them. Now, notice how he summarizes verse 33. These people, now he's talking about those he's just named, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth. We think, who quenched the violence. We remember the three Hebrew children, because they would not worship the image that the king of Babylon had erected. And yet when they were cast into the fire and were walking around in and saw that there was a fourth person there. And that turned out to be the Lord himself, who never abandons his people of faith, never abandons them. And when they came out of the furnace, their clothing wasn't burned, there wasn't the smell of smoke on them. Remarkable indeed. Who quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again. I remember that both Elijah and Elisha were sons living to their widowed mothers. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Faith wins marvelous. But that's not the end of the story. Sometimes faith is called upon to endure defeats. Beginning in verse 35. In talking about great people of faith, the writer does not overlook the fact that sometimes it seems that the people of faith are defeated. But their apparent defeat only deepens their faith and makes them stronger. Here's what he said. And others were tortured, not receiving deliverance. Now Daniel is delivered from the lion's den. The three Hebrew children are delivered from the fiery furnace. But everybody of faith was not delivered. Not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. We believe and have reason to believe that Jeremiah, one of God's great Old Testament prophets, was stoned to death. They were sawn in two. There are those who believe that Isaiah died by being sawn in two. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. Sometimes people of faith endure defeats, but their faith was deepened and made stronger. Of whom the world was not worthy, they wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth, and all of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. You know, these people that he's talking about from the Old Testament period did not live long enough to see the fulfillment of the promise of the coming of the Messiah. They believed that he was coming. God's prophets in the Old Testament foretold his coming, but they didn't live long enough to see it. And yet they died for their faith, and they died in their faith. All of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us. And you know, sometimes I'm ashamed of myself. I have so much more light because I know the New Testament message. I have so much more light than the people in the Old Testament had, but how little my faith seems when I compare it with theirs. God had something better for us, he said. And these Hebrew Christians who were about to leave Christ, the writer must have been wanting them to feel some of that shame. They're about to walk away from Christ, and yet here were people in the Old Testament who died for their faith, and they didn't even live long enough to see the coming of Jesus. God having provided something better for us, we've seen that they should not be made perfect apart from us. One of these days, all of those who lived faithfully to God in the Old Testament and who died before Jesus came are going to be a part of the resurrection of the dead, and the dead will be raised at the voice of Jesus. And they with us will be perfected in the presence of God. How much so many have suffered for their faith? Have you ever suffered for your faith? And I wonder what it would have been like to have been thrown in jail because you were a believer. No other reason, but you are a believer, so you're in jail. Or what would it be like to have been scourged, like Paul was ever so often, because of faith? About the most that we've ever suffered for our faith is that maybe somebody said something to us that hurt our feelings. And these that are named and listed in Hebrews 11 are not the only ones. And I want to read to you a part of a story. The testamental period. What I mean by that is the period between the close of the Old Testament, about 425 B.C., and the beginning of the new era, when John the Baptist came announcing Jesus in the first century. The Jewish people hardly ever had any time that they were free people. Now, when God brought the nation out of Egyptian bondage and brought them through a wilderness and finally brought them into the land of Canaan, there was a period of time that we could say that they were free people. But it wasn't very long that they began to be oppressed by their enemies. And usually it was because they had forgotten God. So in 722 B.C., the Assyrians swept down from the northeast, captured Israel, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, and carried them off into captivity and they never came back, and it was because they forgot God. A little over 100 years later, Judah is in the south by herself. She learned little or nothing from the captivity of her sister Israel. She forgot God as well. And the Babylonians come from the Mesopotamian Valley, and they dominate all that part of the world, and there is the 70 years of Babylonian captivity. And after the 70 years in Babylon, they returned home and rebuilt their national life in the land of Israel, but they were dominated by the Persians. And then later on, they're dominated by their northern neighbor, the Syrians. And in between all of that, there's Egypt, who sometimes was dominating Israel. You see, Israel was in a precarious position geographically. She had the Mediterranean Sea on her western border. She had the Arabian Desert on her eastern border. To the south, there's Egypt. To the north, there was Syria and Assyria. And to the northeast, there was Babylon and Persia. That made Israel a sort of crossroads of that part of the world. And if some nation like Syria or Assyria or Babylon was going to invade Egypt, they'd come right down through Israel. And if Egypt felt strong enough that they were going to invade some of the nations of the north, they'd go right up through the land of Israel. Israel was in a place that made them a part of whatever was happening around. And they were always, it seems, dominated by somebody. Well, in the 2nd century B.C., the Syrians came down and invaded Egypt, defeated Egypt, and made Israel a Syrian colony. The emperor of Syria at the time was a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. He hated the Jews. And he hated their religion. And one of his goals was to destroy the religion of Israel. And so he took all their holy writings that he could find and burned them. He went to the altar at the temple in Jerusalem and sacrificed a pig. Now that was the height of hatred, because pigs were unclean to the Jews. He offered a pig on their altar. Moreover, he demanded that the Jewish people, under the penalty of death, eat pig meat, which was unclean to them. Now that's the setting. There is a group of books called the Apocrypha. They're not inspired books, but some of them contain history of that era. And there isn't any reason for us to doubt the history any more than we would doubt the history of the United States of America or a history of the southern states or the Civil War or anything of that nature. These are historical documents in some cases. Two of the books in the Apocrypha are 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They tell us some Jewish history. They tell about Antiochus Epiphanes coming and offering a pig on the altar in Jerusalem. And that so outraged the Jewish people. And Antiochus did not understand, before he did that dastardly deed, the resolve of the Jewish people. And when he offered the pig on the altar and was forcing Jewish people to eat pig meat and to denounce their religion, That led to what is called historically the Maccabean Revolt. And even though they were outnumbered, and as we express it, outgunned, they were able to defeat the Assyrians. And they had something over 80 years of freedom until the Romans came and dominated them again. In 2 Maccabees chapter 7, there is a story told of a Jewish woman who was a widow. She had 7 sons. Antiochus was in Jerusalem, and he came to the woman and said, "You're going to eat pig's meat." And she said, "I will die, but I will not eat pig's meat." He said, "Then I will kill your 7 sons while you watch." She said, "You may kill my 7 sons, but I will not defile my conscience and my law." And she encouraged her 7 sons to die rather than to eat pig's meat. And Antiochus brought the first son and said, "Denounce your faith and eat swine's meat." And he said, "I will die, but I will not eat pig's meat." Antiochus had his extremities cut off, and his mother and brothers were watching. And among his last words were that he would be true to God no matter what, and he died. And Antiochus brought the second son, made the same threat. The son, encouraged by his mother, had the same resolve. And Antiochus did the same thing to him, slowly torturing him to death. And then the third son. Finally, all of the first 6 were dead, and only the youngest remained. And the mother must have been fearful that the youngest boy would somehow be too weak to withstand the threats, and she encouraged him especially. And he made moving statements of faith that I've ever read. And even though he was a young boy, he said, in effect, "I will die before I violate the law of God." And he was killed before his mother's eyes, like the other 6 had killed. And the woman herself was dragged before Epiphanes, tortured, being tied between 2 wheels which were turned in opposite directions that literally separated joint from joint. Then she was dismembered. She was scalped and burned. And thus the whole family died. And she witnessed the death of her 7 sons. What kind of faith is that? And I have difficulty in just being nice to people. I have difficulty in doing the most menial task that a Christian would do. And it's so easy for me, those that have gone before. Now, this was before the Christian era. But similar things happened after the church began, especially under the persecutions of the Roman emperors. We have reason to believe historically that Peter, the apostle of Jesus, was crucified head downward. And it is said that he was going to be crucified, but he didn't feel that he was worthy to be crucified like his Lord, and so he asked them to crucify him with his head down. And Paul was beheaded, we have reason to believe, in Rome at the persecutions of the church in AD 68. I wonder how we would have fared under that of a persecution. Now, the writer of Hebrews is holding up people. People who have grace and who for their faith sometimes they endured defeat. But their faith grew stronger, and we must note this before we leave this second point. Their faith grew stronger, and they did win the ultimate victory. People could take away their lives, but they couldn't take away their faith. Now, down at the end of the chapter, there's a faith excites trust. Faith says, I'm going to trust God no matter what. I'm going to endure. I'll never give up. I'm going to win, and I will never be defeated. Probably every person in this room tonight remembers the words that Winston Churchill spoke. He came to this country to speak to a commencement at a college graduation. And it was in and under the dark clouds of the Nazi blitz on London. There was no reason to believe that England was going to survive. And when Churchill came to America and made his speech, it was brief and to the point. He said, never, never, never give up. And that was his speech. You might wonder, so I don't make a speech like that. If I could make a speech that few words with that much dynamic, I think I'd try. And the writer of Hebrews is saying to his readers, never, never, never give up, no matter what. So having laid that out before his readers, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author, the originator is the meaning of the word, the author and finisher, he inspires us in our faith. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross and despised the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, in the context of suffering for faith, he mentioned the Old Testament worthies, and then he pointed to Jesus. Jesus himself, the greatest example of faith that we know, endured the cross and despised the shame. Because there was joy set before him. The joy was that in his death and in his shame, he'd be able to lead many sons and daughters into glory. He would save us by his death. And no sooner does Paul talk about, if he be the author of Hebrews, and he might have been, we're not sure. But if he be the writer of Hebrews, no sooner does he speak of the faith that was on undaunted faith of the Old Testament worthies, and the faith of Christ that brought salvation to us. All of them suffering for their faith. Sometimes clearly winning the victory, sometimes seeming to suffer defeat. Then he turned to the Hebrew Christians and he said, God will use whatever suffering comes to you as a chastening rod to make you better and stronger, and will give you the strength to endure. The Christian life is a race to be run. Now let me say a couple of things about that, and then I'll close tonight. Paul is the one who uses this imagery. The Christian life is a race. Here he said, run with endurance. Don't give up. Don't stop. Just keep going, no matter what. And keep your eye on Jesus. He's at the end to reward you. So keep your eye on him. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul, you said that he was running a race, and that the race that he was running was the race that his readers were running. It's the Christian race. And he said, do you not know that those who run in a race like the Olympics, they all run, but one receives the crown? In the Olympics, there's just one winner. But he said, in the Christian race, you keep running with endurance because everybody who finishes is a winner. There isn't any second and third place. Everybody receives the crown. They that run in a race run all the crown, but you run so that you can receive the crown. And you can receive the crown by finishing the course. And then he said, I keep under my body. I'm one of the runners, he said. And I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, after I preach to others, I myself might be a castaway. What he's saying is that those who compete in the race must be temperate. You see, an athlete who succeeds has to have self-control. If he's a runner, he has to practice his running even when he doesn't feel like it. And he has to run further and run longer than his race will ever be, because he has to prepare, exercise himself. Friend Timothy, Paul spoke of the Christian life as a race, and he said, they that picture a little track. And here's a man that is not going to win the race. He's too far behind. And around the oval, he just cuts across. And now he's leading the pack. You think he would receive? Of course not. He has to run lawfully. So in running the Christian race, first of all, we have to practice running lawfully. We must be Christians. It's not just that we lean that way. We're Christians. And from the New Testament book of Acts, we learn that Christians are penitent, baptized believers. They pictured the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ in their death to sin and being buried when they were baptized and raised to walk in newness of life. They've obeyed Christ for the forgiveness of sins. They're in the race. You must run lawfully. And those who are running lawfully practice self-control in that they're going to do the right thing even when they don't want to or don't feel like it. It's not what I feel like doing, it's what is the right thing to do. And then as we run with endurance, never giving up. Jesus is at the end, and all who finish receive the crown. That's quite wonderful, isn't it? Are you in the Christian race? You're running lawfully, running with endurance, running with patience. Maybe you haven't started yet. Maybe you've started and quit. Do something about that. We'll help you with it tonight. Let's stand and be singing.